We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. And I think Tim's going to come introduce our speaker.
This might be confusing to you because it's Tim introducing Tim. But Tim Moore has been involved with this speaker meeting for at least 8 years. And this will make 6 years since the first time I ever came into this meeting, which was my very first AA meeting ever. And Tim was chairing that meeting. He made such a great impact in my life. But he's probably one of the most anonymous alcoholics out there because this is the very first time that he'll be telling his personal recovery story in the room that he's dedicated years of sobriety. So he'll fill you in on all the details, but I just wanted to ask you guys to give him a warm round of applause. Come on up here, Tim.
Hey everybody, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. And for 8 years, a little over 8 years, I've told people when they come to this platform, no matter where they were from, that you're at home here. But I really am at home here. And I'll tell you how I wound up doing this tonight. Every year, Tim's such a polite guy. He always asks me on his birthday, why don't I tell my story? I say, no, let's get somebody else. And every year, and he'll celebrate 6 years tonight. And this year, we had three different people that canceled. You know, he asked me first, said, no, let's get somebody. They called and canceled. Got somebody else. They called and canceled. Got somebody else and they called again. I said, well, I guess I'm supposed to do it this year. It's just the way it is. So you're stuck with me tonight. But it's great to be here. It's good to see everybody. Good to see some friends that have came in, busy, and people in my men's group. I appreciate them coming. Troy is on the lookout tonight. He said, if I leave something out, he's going to raise his hand and let me know. He's heard my story so many times. But it's good to see him. But my sobriety date is January 7th, 2003. This is my home group, and I also say Bridge Builders is my home group. Debbie's a mainstay there. Met Debbie early on. And tell you a little about myself and some of the things that got me standing before you tonight. I was born right here in Atlanta, Georgia, 1957. I'm 55. I was born at Georgia Baptist Hospital. My father is a Baptist preacher, and he was preaching when I was born. He has two brothers, and they're Baptist preachers. And his father, my grandfather, is a Baptist preacher. And so church was my life. I grew up around church people, and first time I was being checked into rehab, I still remember the lady asked me, how long you been on drugs? I said, all my life. I've been drugged to church Sunday morning, Sunday night. A little anger issue going on there. My parents actually brought me home from Georgia Baptist to Decatur, where I live now. I live in Decatur, Georgia. My father has pastored six churches. He pastored a church in Northwest Atlanta, a couple other churches. But, you know, the last church he just resigned from a couple of years ago, he pastored 45 years. But, you know, when I was 10 months old, they knew. They could tell something was going on with me. I don't know what triggered them off. And the doctor found I had a blood clot. And they did emergency brain surgery on me at Georgia Baptist. And they went in on the wrong side at first, and then went in the other side and didn't know if I'd make it, but, you know, I came in okay. Stayed in the hospital 5 weeks. And funny little thing I'll tell you later, but I've got a lot of scars. Now, I've gone to the same hairstylist 10 years. She knows how to hide them, but I've got scars all over the place. But anyway, I stayed in the hospital 5 weeks, and they let me go home. And for the first 13 months after that, I had to wear a little helmet in the house. My parents have still got pictures of it. And they said he can't bump his head on anything. You know, don't know what could happen. Be real careful with him. And once a month, bring him back to the hospital. Then we'll change the dressing. And I can't imagine what that was like for my parents. You know, just knowing a child was, you know, toddling around the house like that with a little helmet. And I still think that's got something to do with why they're so protective of me. And some of my friends here tonight that know my family will say it is ridiculous how protective they are. But, of course, I figured out a way to turn that against them later. You know, if they let me, you know, have some hard knocks on my own, maybe I wouldn't have, you know, turned out the way I did. But, like, how dare you love me so much? But anyway, I recovered from that, and I've been very healthy all my life. I've been blessed with great health. And when I was 8 years old, we moved to Gwinnett County. My father took a small church in Suwanee, Georgia, that was really, really in the country. And went to Suwanee Elementary, then North Gwinnett High School. And I was a quiet kid. Had one sister, a couple of years younger than me. A quiet kid. I was a good kid. And I was totally never, ever around alcohol. I think one of my grandfathers, when he was very young, had a problem drinking, but I was never around any alcohol. And maybe hard for some people to believe, but one, give you an illustration. When I was about 4 years old, my parents went to Florida, and they tell a story that they had, the place they were staying in, it was a cabin on the beach, and whoever had been there before left a couple of beers in the refrigerator. And I was about 3 or 4. When I saw the beers, it terrified me so bad, they didn't know if they were going to be able to stay, because I was scared to death just seeing a beer in the refrigerator. That's how I was terrified. And maybe somebody was trying to tell me something then. But, so, you know, unlike a lot of people in this room, I just never was around alcohol at all. It was totally foreign to my experience. And, you know, our friends were church friends. You know, we did everything in the church. It was good people. And it was a happy childhood. It really was. And nothing really noteworthy, you know, happened, I guess, for a long time. I had my first drink when I was 15 years old, a little later than a lot of people. We stole a beer from a convenience store, and I had a couple of swigs of it. And I really thought I'd got a spoiled beer. It tasted so bad. I still remember it was a Michelob in the brown bottle, and I thought, nobody would drink this. And I've got a bad one, obviously. And I sipped on a couple more here and there. And then when I was, I think, 17, I had a friend who lived at the Darlington Apartments on Peachtree across from Piedmont Hospital, where the population sign is. And I went down and stayed once. We were running around and stayed with him one Saturday night, and he had a bottle of Cutty Sark scotch and some soda. And I started drinking scotch and soda, and it happened. It happened that night. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And got up the next day, didn't feel that horrible, and, you know, just started drinking when I could get away with it. I was really a closet drinker, though, because, you know, my parents, none of the people I was around at that time drank, so I drank on the sly, snuck around and drank here and there. Went to college, and did okay in college. I was editor of my newspaper for a year. And then when I went to Georgia State, I started working to get through, it's a long story, but working to get through college in the car business, the wholesale car business on Stewart Avenue here in Atlanta. And some of you that don't know Atlanta or young people, Stewart Avenue is the only street in Atlanta. It had such a bad reputation, they finally had a big ceremony with the mayor and just changed the name of the street, because it had such a, that's where Ford grew up, really, Stewart Avenue. But it had such a bad reputation, they had a ceremony and said, we're not going to have it, just, and that's Metropolitan Avenue now. But it was car lots everywhere, it was gambling, it was bars, and Fun Town, that's right, Daryl. Fun Town, that's right. And there was some crazy things going on down there. And I was 18 or 19 years old, going to school in the morning, then working there in the afternoons and night. And a lot of crazy stories. But I had some people that looked out for me. I really did, old guys. I could have got in a lot of trouble down there. But some guys looked out for me. And I made it out of there without too much damage, you know, played around with drinking, but it didn't really get a hold of me, you know, down there, and finished. And met a girl when I got a pretty good job in commercial real estate. That's what I'd always wanted to do when I got out of college. Met a nice girl, and she actually knew my family through the church she went to. My father had preached in her church. And we started dating, and her mother told her right after she found out who she was dating, "This is great, you know, I don't have to worry as a preacher, son." Boy, if she had any idea. But really nice young lady, and we got married. And it's funny how your perception of things change even in sobriety. The first couple of times I told my story, this was 6 or 7 years ago, I would say when I first got married, I didn't really have any problem drinking. And one day it hit me. I remembered when we went on our honeymoon, I made sure in the little hide compartment in the suitcase, I had an 8-ball and 90 Valium, and I bought a bottle of Wild Turkey for my honeymoon. But I didn't think I had a problem with that. I really didn't. And, you know, things just, it's crazy the way things, your mind, you keep changing. Your story doesn't change, but my perception of my story changes. You really realize it's, you know, you get more and more clarity, hopefully. But the first couple of years were okay, and then I really started a downward spiral. Drinking wasn't just a weekend thing then. Drinking was a necessity. And there were a lot of narcotics involved in my story. I won't dwell on it, but it's safe to say there's a lot of abuse there. And the marriage just descended, but neither one of us believed in divorce because none of our family had been divorced, so we just toughed it out and stayed married. And I was really rough on my first wife. It's a really blessing. It's a blessing that we get along today the way we do. But, you know, we wear people out when we're drinking. Don Williamson told me that, and that's right. I wore a lot of people out. And but anyway, she hung in there and just had some insane things. And without going into a lot of drunkologues, just to give you an idea of the effect alcohol had on me, just a couple of things. I thought about this over the weekend with the Kentucky Derby. I'm sure some of you have heard me tell this story, but I went to the Kentucky Derby while I was still drinking with a friend. We drove up there. Anybody here ever been to the Kentucky Derby? Well, in the infield, the Kentucky Derby is basically the same as the cheap seats, if you've never been. And it's like Mardi Gras. Everybody's partying. Everybody's drunk. And I was in the infield. They threw me out. They really did. And when I tell people that, they say, you can't get thrown out of there. I said, no, you can get thrown out of the infield. That is what this quiet, unassuming, mild guy from Swanee, who never gave anybody any trouble, that's what happened when you put alcohol in my system. And I remember one night we went to Lakewood, my wife and I, to see Rod Stewart. We got separated, and I don't know, I was in a blackout. By the way, I was a definite blackout drinker from the snap. I was a blackout drinker. And we got separated at Lakewood. I wound up getting somebody to drive me from Lakewood to Swanee. I think I gave him $100 or something. And I got there before she did. And they just let me out in front of my house. Somehow or other, they looked at my license and figured out where I lived. And but she wasn't home yet, and I didn't have my keys. I'd lost my house keys, and I needed a drink. So in front of our house, we had hanging baskets right in front of the windows. And I threw a hanging basket through a plate glass window and walked through it and went inside and poured myself a drink. And when my wife got home, I was sitting there in front of the television having a drink like everything was fine. And that's just the effect it had on me. And it's amazing, you know, that I survived like I did. I went in after about 4 years in commercial real estate. I got back in the car business, and it was the Wild West where I worked. I mean, it was a lot of young guys. We made really good money, and basically the old guys that owned the dealership let you do anything you wanted to do, and it was just the Wild West. It was really crazy. And Michelle, I don't see Michelle here yet tonight, but I found out last week that her dad owned Hub Ford, Michelle. And her cousin, Rocky, who passed away right after this, took me to my first AA meeting. I didn't know that until last week. and we lost Rocky in about 2000 to this disease. But he took me to my first AA meeting in 1994. And I want to say something. I started getting in legal trouble, had a DUI, totaled a car, this and that, and started having to come and get my sheet signed at meetings. And I've been sober 10 years, and I remember things now that I heard sitting in meetings that I didn't want to be in the meeting. And I didn't want to listen to the people that was talking. But I got things out of those meetings that helped me today. So if you're here and you don't want to be here, you might still be glad one day you heard some things that you're going to hear in these meetings. And, you know, just continued on. Let's see. Finally, we decided to have a baby, and I had a little boy. And, you know, people that say, I don't necessarily go along with people that say, I chose drinking over my family. I chose drinking over my kids. From the first second of my son's life when I saw him in the delivery room, I would have died for him right then. No questions asked. And he's 18 now, and there's never been one minute in his life I wouldn't die for him. But I could not quit drinking for him. It wasn't a choice. Any more than breathing's a choice. I had to drink. I had to do other things. And, you know, I put him in harm's way a few times. And I'm so glad, you know, God was looking out for me there. And finally, my wife had enough. When he was 3 years old, she left. And insanity really took off then. And I got in some trouble. I got several things I got in trouble. I was on intensive probation 6 months. The day I got off intensive probation, they called me 10 o'clock in the morning and said, you're off intensive probation today. I was drunk 2 hours later. And a week later, I was picked up, tested positive for morphine, and they gave me 4 months in boot camp. And I went to boot camp. I was 37, and it really wasn't that bad, because at that age, all they make you do is cut grass at the courthouse, or at least at this one they did, I.W. Davis up in Jefferson. But they shaved my head, and when they shaved my head, I got scars everywhere, like I told you. And people started coming up to me, and they'd say, hey, man, what happened to your head? And I'd just give them a look and say, I don't talk to anybody about what happened to my head. So I kind of got the reputation of a badass, which could not be further from the truth. They'd only known. And I made it out of boot camp and came back and really, you know, worked a little bit. Wasn't able to do a lot. But I worked with some people that looked out for me and gave me some business in real estate. And, you know, finally, wrecked another car, totaled another car, got away before the cops got there, and I dodged that one. And the last, let's see, 8:30, we better start getting slower. The last year I was on methadone, and because, you know, I had to do something. I was on methadone, and I was about broke, couldn't afford to buy them off the street anymore. I'm sure some people know methadone, and it's brutal. But one morning, this is my bottom for me. One morning, I'm standing in line at a methadone clinic. It's about 6 in the morning. And the lineup outside the clinic, I'm sure some of you have been there, and this is down in Norcross. And I'm explaining to this guy in front of me, he's a good bit older than me, how I'm going to quit. And I'm as serious as I've ever been in my life. I'm telling him, this is what I'm going to do. I've got it figured out. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And the guy turned around and looked at me, and he said, pal, you're never going to quit. And I said, no, you don't get it. He said, no, wait a minute. He said, look, I'm older than you, buddy. I've been doing this a long time. Guys like me and you don't get better. Let's just ride it out and don't fight it. This is the way it's going to be. And when he said that, I had been in jail. I had talked to counselors. I'd been in rehab 3 times, once inpatient, twice outpatient. I had talked to shrinks. My parents had flown spiritual people in from all over the country to talk to me. But that guy flipped a switch in me nobody had ever flipped before, because I knew he was right. And all of a sudden, I had a moment of clarity. I saw myself. And I saw what my life had been. And he just turned around, didn't say another word. And somewhere from inside, I said, God, please help me. And something happened that morning. I can't explain it. I'll never. But that was my bottom. Something happened that morning. And I did take another drink and did a couple of other things. But a couple of weeks later, January 7th, 2003, I went back to the Gwinnett Room, the lunch bunch, and I picked up a white chip. And basically, I was unemployable at that time. I had a little income off some lease residuals enough to keep me afloat, and I was living by myself up in Lawrenceville. Picked up a white chip. Don't remember one word that was said in the meeting. Remember something after the meeting. I'll tell you later, but don't remember one word. And I just started going to meetings. And I called the AA office, and after a few days, I met a guy up there, asked me if he'd be my sponsor. He never called me back. Asked another guy if he'd be my sponsor. He said, well, I'm just in town today. I live 60 miles from here, so you can call me. But I was just going to meetings. I called the central office, and I said, look, I can't sleep. I'm up all night, and I need the earliest meeting in Atlanta that I can go to. And Helen Rowe, I wrote her name down on a piece of paper. She said, there's a 6:15 meeting at 8111 if you want to drive that far. And I said, I think I'm going to go there. And I said, if any of you know Helen, she said, well, I think you'd better. You know, so, and she was right. But I went to that meeting. I'd get there early in the morning, sit in the parking lot, and maybe go to the Waffle House. And I knew, and I was just dying. The world had fell in on top of me. And one morning, after 3 or 4 days, I actually shared what was going on with me. I didn't try to sound cute. And I said, everything in my life has fell apart. And if anybody talked to me after this, I'd appreciate it. And a guy came up to me afterwards and introduced himself, and we started talking, Ken H. at 8111, and he became my sponsor, and he's my sponsor today. And we sat up at the front table at 8111, I guess for an hour, when he started telling me about yourself, and I started telling him, and after a while he said, well, I think you've done step one, Tim. And I talked a little longer, and he said, well, I think you've done step two. That was good enough for me, you know. And he said, I'll tell you what, I want you to read, you know, outline some things in the books, and I want you to read this tonight. And meet me here in the morning. We'll go downstairs and say the third step prayer. I said, okay. And I got ready to leave. And he said the magic words. He said, you'll never have to feel like this again. And if you've ever felt like that, you know what that feels like. And I walked to my car, and I've never felt like that again. I found hope that morning from somebody I trusted, and came back the next day. We did the third step prayer, and I was so, you know, I'd heard all these people talk about God and surrendering, and I thought, how do I know if I've really surrendered to God? How do I really know if I've turned my will over? Sandra and I were talking about this last week. She's here somewhere. And somebody told me you surrender to a process. Nowhere in the literature does it say you have to find God at the third step. I'm sure some of you do, but it doesn't say you have to. But you make a decision to do the steps and to follow the suggestions of the program. And so that's what I started doing. I started going to meetings everywhere. Somebody told me about NABA, and I came to NABA a couple of weeks later and started coming to the 11 o'clock meeting here, and I was here pretty much every day my first 5 years. My social calendar was not real jammed up, you know, when I got here. And I made great friends here, and it was just amazing. And sponsor said you need to do the fourth step. And I hesitated on the fourth step, but it wasn't because I didn't want to do it. But by then, I'm grabbing speaker tapes from everybody, listening to a lot of speaker tapes. And I'm hearing Earl Hightower and, you know, Chip Collins, all this stuff. And I thought mine just wasn't jazzy enough. You know, there's nothing really interesting in my fourth step. And one day I was talking to Harry. I hear old Harry back there. And we were right back there, and he said, I've been seeing you come around. How you doing? I said, well, I'm trying to do my fourth step. I don't know if I'm getting anywhere. He said, well, my experience is you need to look for patterns. I'd never heard anybody talk about patterns in the fourth step before. And when I did that, it started to make sense. I started to be able to put it down. And, you know, I figured out, for me, my life was like a series of remakes of a bad movie. The plot never changed, but the faces changed. The relationships with women were the same. The job relationships were the same. Friend relationships were the same. The messes I'd get in were the same. It was just the same plot, different faces, over and over and over. And that really got me going on my fourth step. And when I did my fifth step with my sponsor, We went to the river, the Chattahoochee River, and did it. And when we finished, he said, what have you learned from about yourself in this process? And it just came out from somewhere. I said, you know, Ken, I think if you put me up in a plane and pushed me out anywhere in the country with a parachute and came back in a year, I'd be in the same kind of trouble with the same kind of people. I'd carry it with me. And that was really insightful for me, and I appreciate that. Then we did 6 and 7. And then we got started on the amends. And for me, from the first meeting, when I looked on the wall and I saw the 8th step and the 9th step, I said, there's one I can't do. And it involved an employer that I had worked for 10 years earlier. I stole a few $1,000 from them. I managed a rental car agency. And I really don't think they had any idea. I still don't. And we had a good relationship. We still did business together. And I do the amends, the family amends, what I'd consider some of the easier amends. And Ken would ask me, well, what about that one with your former employer? I said, well, look, we're going to be doing these steps forever, right? He said, yeah. I said, I'll just catch this one on the next pass. And he said, no, I don't think that's going to work. And then I remember later we were talking. He said, what about your previous employer? I said, well, look, I figure it's about $3,000, $4,000. So we'll call it $4,000. I'm broke. I got nothing. Let me get up $500 and go see him. And when I got $500, then I'll have a little credibility and I won't look like a fool. He said, no, you can't do that either. He said, you're trying to manipulate how they're going to act. You don't have any control over how he's going to act. You just go up there and tell him what happened. I said, oh, man. And finally he said, Tim, you don't have to do this. You just have to do it if you want to stay sober. And I wanted to stay sober. And I prayed about it, did the other amends I could. And I woke up one morning, and it was like a burden had lifted. And I felt as relaxed going to see that guy as I would walking back there and getting a cup of coffee. I called him, made an appointment, and went in. Told him what I did. I said, about 10 years ago, this is what I did. And I got nothing. Can't give you anything. You tell me what to do, and I'll do it. And we worked out a arrangement. I'd pay him a little money along on interest and then pay him the amount when I could. I said, I'm starting to work again. And I got up to leave, and he shook hands. And it was amazing. This amends. I know they don't all go that way. But he said, we're better friends than we've ever been, and it'll never leave this office. You'll never get a call from me. You do the best you can. And now, I don't think we go by feeling in this program. But I had a feeling when I left that office I'd never had before because I walked through some fear. I didn't walk around it. I just walked through the fear. My sponsor's big on that term, walk through the fear. And I got busy. I was lucky that year. Business was okay. And about a year later, I came back and I wrote that guy in the same office a check for the full amount. And that felt good. But that didn't feel as good as the day I went in there with nothing. And just told him what I did. So anybody that's, you know, intimidated by the 8th step and the 9th step, I really recommend my experience. That's the one where the lights really came on for me. And, you know, I just went to a lot of meetings. Mike Kay, I talked to today. He's working tonight. But he was a musician, so, you know, Mike. And we went to meetings everywhere because he didn't have much of a schedule. And we'd hear about a great meeting in Athens. We'd ride to Athens or we'd go wherever. And, you know, I'd go to a meeting and I'd say, this is the greatest meeting. I'm never going to miss it again. Then I'd go a couple of days later and say, they're all crazy. I'm never going back. Well, the thing is, I was crazy. I was detoxing and things were changing. But that's okay. Okay, you know, we were like, and every night we talk on the phone. We still do sometimes now for an hour, hour and a half, just talking about this stuff, talking about recovery in AA. And it's, you know, if you hang around AA too, you're going to see some miracles in your life. I remember I was coming up on 9 months sober, getting my 9 month chip, and the lady I was dating at the time, a year earlier, her parents had given us a trip to Puerto Rico. And she was a heavy drinker, very heavy drinker, and I was scared to death. And my sponsor said, just pray about it. And I'd called Puerto Rico, and the AA hotline there said, there's not really a meeting right where you're at, but you can call us and at least talk to us on the phone when you get there. I said, okay, that's good. And we were going to leave Sunday morning at 7 o'clock, and I went to the 7 o'clock meeting at 8111 Saturday morning. This is 24 hours before we're to leave. And I went in the meeting, there might have been seven or eight people there, small meeting early in the morning. Then I just shared, going to Puerto Rico, I'm coming up on my 9-month ship. I'm really nervous about this, and hope you'll say a prayer for me. When the meeting was over, a guy walked up to me who I'd never seen before. And he said, guess where I'm going to be on business next week? I said, where? He said, 5 minutes from your hotel. And he gave me my 9-month ship in Puerto Rico. And hang around here, you'll have things like that happen to you. I mean, I could go on about that, but it was great. And but anyway, got the amends done, went on and started working with some new people. I remember my first 12-step call, I met Sam Harrison. He uses his last name, so I will. And Bill and I then went to see somebody on a 12-step call who'd gone back out and started drinking. And I'm on my way over there, and I call Sam. And I said, Sam, I've never done this. What am I supposed to tell this guy? And Sam said, Timmy, I'll tell you like they told me. He said, if this guy wants to get sober, you ain't going to be able to talk him out of getting sober. And if he doesn't, there's nothing you can say that's going to make any difference. You just tell him what happened to you. And that's the best advice you can give anybody about working with the newcomers, I think. You know, it took me a while to figure out, newcomers don't really care what you know till they know that you care. You know, I wanted to tell everybody how smart I was for a long time, but newcomers want somebody who cares. You know, I could, you know, just that feeling of going from people were concerned about me, then people were angry with me, and then people were just sad about me. When I'd look at somebody and they'd just look sad, they wouldn't even try to get through to me anymore. And then I'd come here, and people really cared here. This room has done amazing things have happened in my life in this room. I think about Beverly, Debbie's old sponsor, who said, you know, come get me. And I remember I got my 30-day chip right here, and she said, that's a long damn time, baby. And it was. And she'd get me to lead a meeting, and I'd finish. She'd say, boy, you lead the best meetings. We need you here. No, I didn't. But that's just the way people talk to me. I remember Bud the Alcoholic saying, man, we need you. We're a better meeting because you're here. It's been a long time since anybody told me we need you here. It's been an awful long time. And I remember I might have been 3 months sober, and Bobby Jones picked up a chip here. And he was sharing, and he mentioned he'd been in prison and all that, and he said, and since I've been in AA, I've got a full pardon from the governor's office. And I thought, man, I didn't know you could do that. That's amazing. Fast forward about 4 years, I called Bobby, found out what he did, got a lawyer, I got a full pardon for felonies that were on my record from the governor's office. I've told other people about that. Some of them are here, and they've got pardons. That's the way AA works. You know, you learn what happens here. And my wife, who's here tonight, we met in this room. And the way it worked with us, for the first 3 years, we were good buddies. We'd go to lunch. We'd go to the movies, maybe. And that was it. You know, just really had a good time. And after a few years, something changed all of a sudden one night. And in 6 months, we were married. And the end of this month, we will have been married 5 years. And, you know, it's just really been amazing the things that have happened. My son's in college. He's 18 years old. I've got a great relationship with that first wife, and she's got a great relationship with Connie, you know, that we all get along, her husband and I get along. And miracles really do happen here. And it's just, you know, it amazes. And, you know, when I was thinking today, if you had told that guy standing in that line at the methadone clinic, come to a few meetings, talk to some people, and get involved in this program, and this is what can happen in a few years. It was too much to even fathom. I would never have hoped for that. But it's just amazing what AA has done in my life and the blessing it's been in my life. And, you know, we've got some birthdays. Two of my favorite people have got birthdays, and we've got cake, and good to see everybody. But Harry would want me to finish up with this. The one thing I do remember with my first meeting where I got the white chip, is I finished in Grace, a lady at Lawrenceville, who everybody knew Grace. She'd been sober about 25 years. She's dead now. But she gave me my white chip, and when the meeting was over, I was trying to get to my car, and she grabbed me in the parking lot. She said, honey, tell me about yourself. Real southern lady, sponsored a lot of women up there and everything. And I just, you know, I'm shaking and sweating and sick, and I just started talking to her, and she said, "Well, you're going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. You just come back tomorrow, and you know, it's going to get better. I promise." And she said, "Honey, I'm going to tell you how you can be unique in AA." She said, "Now you go get you a book and get you a sponsor. You do everything that sponsor says. You be totally honest with him, and you do those steps thoroughly, and don't make any changes in your life the first year, and don't get in any relationships your first year, and you're going to be unique in AA because nobody's ever done it." But she said, "Now everybody's going to tell you that's what they did. We tell all the newcomers that's what, but nobody's ever done everything right. But why don't you do this? Why don't you get on your knees when you wake up tomorrow morning and ask God to keep you sober? Get to a meeting tomorrow, talk to some alcoholics. You know, if you get in trouble, call somebody and talk about it. And if you make it tomorrow night before you go to bed, get down on your knees and thank God for keeping you sober. And you just see what happens." That is what I have done, and that has been my experience. I love all y'all. Appreciate you coming, and thanks for having me.
Tim, that was good. I've asked John to get on the ship.
Thanks, John. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Here we have a white chip. This is the surrender chip. If you want to come in Alcoholics Anonymous and not take a drink the rest of the day, come get a white chip. Anybody? Any other white chips? Anybody got 30 days for the silver chip? Days, red chip. You got 90 days? All right, pretty good, huh? Yellow chip, 6 months. Chip or the kudzu chip, the go chip, go for the blue. But this is the green for 9 months. Anybody? Anybody pregnant with the program? Come on. With the program, Natalie. Do we have anybody that sneakers for years we don't know about?
I'm Clayton. I'm an alcoholic. 21 years. I've got a proposition. I've got this in this hand. I've got this in my right hand. I'd like to trade this for the young man over there. I'm going to swap my two.
My name is Bernie, and I also have 21 years. And that's just a little bit longer than Clayton, but that is exactly what happens through sobriety, and I'm just. It was really cool. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
My name is Brian. I'm powerless over alcohol, especially not drinking. this, when I came in, I would always go to this meeting. Excuse me? I'll tell you in a minute. I would always come to this meeting because it was story time every once a week. I'd tell you stories. God, that's cool, man. And then, but because that was the only light part of my life, you know, everything else was drudgery and sorrow and pain. Anyway, and so I kept coming back, and things happened, and I stayed sober. God, that's amazing. But actually, I had to experiment with marijuana for over 2 years when I first came in, and but this is for 28 years clean.
Sometimes very slowly. I'm an alcoholic, and this is my friend Tim. Most of you know, and everything Tim gets involved with, he makes better, and I mean that everything. I met Tim at this meeting 6 years ago. This was his first meeting. We started to get working together that night, and Tim is an amazing story. I think he was on a bicycle that night, and Mark drove you home or something.
But that was shortly after the first time. It was one of those nights.
But he has had the worst jobs. He has had financial trouble, but that night he committed to this program, and he has made such a difference at NAPA. He got involved in this meeting. He worked with over here on a website, and we've got over 200 speakers now on our website. Donna worked with him on that. And he got on the board. He did a lot of things on the board. And then he and Tinsley, who's also picking up a chip tonight, and some of you got involved in the coffee house concerts that we have here. And not only has it been big here, it's known all over the metro area and even up north. And in the middle of all that, he lives 50 miles away, and he was diagnosed with cancer. And the only thing, he's never asked for anything but the opportunity to do some service, ever. And it is an honor to call him my friend, and he has taught me the power of a grateful heart, and it's an honor to give you a 6-year chip.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, everyone. And boy, 6 years ago was actually April 30th, 2007. I was sitting up at the lake, and I couldn't stop drinking, and Pam stopped in to visit and said, "Tim, how you doing?" I said, "Not too good." She goes, "Whoa, what do you mean? What, not too good? You're doing great, aren't you?" I said, "Well, I can't stop drinking." And she goes, "Well, I know exactly what we're going to do." And she didn't hesitate. And I said, "Oh, good. Yeah, what are we going to do?" And she goes, "We're going to an AA meeting." And I was like, "Not that," because I'd avoided for 53 years crossing the threshold of AA. I was terrified. But, you know, she let me sit down and think about it for a few minutes and packed a bag. And she drugged me right here. And it was a Monday night. And the guy was telling his story was a fellow that in high school, his big sister was my girlfriend, and I was his dope dealer and his bootlegger. And he had been sober longer than he was old when I started selling him his stuff. And I was in his story. So I always hear about people that identify with somebody in a meeting and say, "I know that guy." Well, I did. And I was in the story. Is that right? That's right. 2 weeks later, Tinsley tells his story in the same room, and I knew I was in the right place then, because I knew how Tinsley drank. Well, he put on a heck of a show, but he put down more beers than I did out in the audience while he was playing. It was incredible. So I could see it was working in his lives, and I was like, wow, man, maybe I got a chance. I might have a chance with this thing. So just wanted to bring Tinsley up because he's celebrating 14 years. Yeah.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And wow, what a meeting, huh? What a story. Thanks, Tim. That was awesome. I knew it would be, too. Love you very much. But really happy tonight. A lot of good stuff going on in my life. And I'm not sure if I'm happy because I'm sober or sober because I'm happy. But either way, it takes a lot of work. And I still take the suggestions that were given to me when I first came into rooms. I go to a ton of meetings. I have a competent sponsor. I sponsor men. Two of them are here tonight. I work all 12 steps in order. That's the roadmap for not only my sobriety, but for my sanity as well. And I've learned to pray. There's something out there, bigger than me. Found them in the rooms right here. Who would have thought of that? And I do some service work, and I've learned to have fun in sobriety. I was a person that couldn't get up in front of a crowd and speak or do anything else without getting wasted. Thought I had to get out of it before I could get into it. And now I can get up in front of people and talk. I never thought I could do that. But Tim mentioned a lot of miracles happen in the room. And for me, the biggest miracle is not that I don't drink. The biggest miracle for me is that I don't want to drink. Thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you everyone for joining in our speakers group tonight.
Together. on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway.